Good evening, college boy. We're going to hell together because we're on the last knock and we're talking about Stephen King's graveyard shift. I'm Johnny, Mr. Foreman Numb. I'm doing a southern Maine accent here, apparently. And joining me tonight, as always, I'm gonna try it anymore. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not doing it either. I'm the drifter from the mid-Atlantic states, Billy Crash.
You here by car or by thumb?
I'm just here for the lobster.
Just lost all our Maine fans.
Yeah, Stephen King just threw his podcast out the window, apparently.
Yeah, no, well, he doesn't he work in a basement, so it didn't get too far.
Well, that radio, that podcast is pretty damn damp down there. I don't see how it's salvageable. Yes, we are discussing the 1990 film, so it's 30 years old, Graveyard Shift, based off a short story by Stephen King. And this was kind of an unusual topic because I tweeted about this movie a few weeks ago, and Billy responded to the tweet saying, "Yeah, I revisited this movie recently too, and I actually liked it." So I was like, "Very, very strange synchronicity going on." So maybe, Bill, what was your first experience with this film? And what was that experience like compared to your more recent experience with Graveyard Shift?
Well, that's the weird part. I forgot how or why I got involved in watching it again. And I was like, ah, it's from the 80s. It should be cool. And I was like, I didn't. And at first I was like, I didn't see this one, did I? And then I'm watching it. And I was like, automatically, it's like, no, I remember Brad Dourif's character. I remember this. And I'm
the Exterminator.
Watching, yeah, and I'm watching. I'm like, man, this is pretty good. And, and then, you know, so when the movie's over, I go to IMDb to check, you know, my original rating, and I gave it 1 star out of, it was like a half star out of 10. And I'm like, well, I'm changing that by 5.5 stars. And I'm like, what happened? How come I hated this thing so much? And how come, you know, I really got into it? It was just insane. The setting alone was like blown my mind.
Yeah, you know, Bill, I had a similar experience. I think I might have blind bought the movie a bunch of years back and gave it a spin and was not initially impressed with it. And then shout out to Scream Factory, they put out a Blu-ray this year with a bunch of supplements and interviews on it.
I gotta get it.
Yeah, and it's good stuff if you like the movie. So, you know, I was just kind of thinking, I felt this little twitch to revisit it when I saw that announced. So I picked up the Blu-ray thinking maybe, you know, I might be getting rid of it after I go through the bonus features.
Yeah.
But you know, I watched the movie and I was like, huh, I'm digging this thing too. And you know, this is a movie that does not have a really good critical reputation. I mean, especially not when it first came out. So I was kind of surprised to be sitting there and kind of taken with the film.
Same here.
And an interesting bit of tidbit is that it was actually shot in Stephen King's, I think where he was living at the time in Bangor, Maine.
Well, part of it was shot there, and the rest of it was shot in Harmony, Maine, at a place called Bartlett Yarns Incorporated, which was and still is the oldest woolen yarn mill in the United States, which was from 1821, and it was renamed Bachman in the movie. We know that that's Stephen King's other wonderful name.
Right.
And the interior shots at the mill and the Riverside Cemetery were all in Harmony. You know, they shot other restaurant, the restaurant and all in Bangor, Maine. We have Bangor, Pennsylvania, Bangor, Maine. I hope the Mainers are back on. Like, okay, those guys are all right. and some things were also shot in Eastland Woolen Mill in Carina, Maine, and which later became a Superfund site.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's like, oh, great. I was working there.
I wonder how big the rats are at that place.
Well, they're like bats, Johnny. Bats the kind, size of Holstein cows.
Well, yeah, you know, I reread the Stephen King short story last night, actually.
Oh, cool.
In preparation for the show. It's been, I probably haven't read it since I was a teenager. You know, and it's interesting when you look at something that's like 15 pages long, and when they stretch it out to a feature film, which was happening with a lot of his stuff back then, you know, when he was a hot commodity, studios were optioning all of his, you know, didn't matter what it was, if it had Stephen King's name on it, if it was a short story or a novel, they were turning it into a movie back in the 80s and
true
early 90s. And this was before like Frank Darabont came along and sort of lent a bit of prestige to his work.
Mm-hmm.
but the book is the short story is interesting because it kind of starts off at the point, like at about the half hour point of the movie, where Warwick, played by the great Stephen Mocht,
oh, he's awesome,
as the Fallman, he's sort of going around assembling the cleanup crew for this basement from hell. Basically, there's just all this crap from decades ago, and
it's endless, man.
and in the film, they kind of set up a good. I like the conceit of there's a safety inspection going on. The safety inspector is like, "There's no way in hell you can pass inspection." And then Warwick bribes the guy with a couple hundreds and gets him off his back for like a week or two, so they can try to fix it up. And yeah, the short story is essentially kind of the last hour of the film, when they're kind of venturing, they find the trap door and they venture kind of deeper into the abandoned caverns or the mine or whatever it is,
right,
where the creature kind of has its lair. So
yeah, it's it had great atmosphere, cool cars, you know, an old Cadillac Coupe de Ville and a, you know, a Mustang. It just had a good feel to it. It's like, you know, what, oh my gosh, his friggin' name. David Andrews. You know, he was the drifter, right? Who comes into town, am I right?
Mr. Hall, yeah.
Yeah. Comes in here, can I have a job? You know, doing that crap, and he walks into this, like, insanity, you know, run by Warwick, this mill that's mm-hmm. just... And it's hot, and everything's sticky and gooey. There's a million rats everywhere. Brad Dourif plays the exterminator who apparently survived Vietnam. He actually has a rice beer patch on his outfit that that apparently American GIs who were in Vietnam, they really enjoyed that beverage. So he had that. And he's all wacky and crazy and, you know, perfect. His hair was awesome. And it, you know, Brad Dourif's, Andrew Devoff is in there too.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Sans beard, long hair, you know, and a dick. You know, like his character's just there.
He's actually trying to do a Maine accent too in that film too. He's like, he and Stephen Mocht are like the only two even attempting a Maine accent.
Yeah, yeah. So that was really cool because, you know, if you love Wishmaster, you know, you want more Andrew Devoff. And real quick, I remember I met Andrew Devoff when he had the mustache thing going on. And he was at Chiller Theater, and I got my autographed Wishmaster picture. And I said, you were great in that. I said, the movie's really fantastic. It's underappreciated. And you were great in it and all. And he's listening to this, and he looks at me, and he says, I wanted to do something good for the genre. And I was like, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And he was just so really cool about it. You know, he was just like, and I was like, man, you were great. Can we go out for cocktails later? It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, you know, it was funny.
He's cool as hell.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, Wishmaster is freaking awesome. I think I have you to thank for loaning me your DVD of that movie a bunch of years back.
I watched that the other night, too. I'm like, nothing's on, man. Amazon Prime's got 8 million pieces of shit I'm going to watch. You know, I'm going to watch Wishmaster. And I watched it on Prime because they had it on there, so that was great.
Yeah, to quote Pink Floyd, I've got 8 million channels of shit on the TV to choose from. Yeah,
yep, you got it.
But no, I think it's interesting because I'd totally forgotten that Andrew Devoff was even in the movie. So rewatching it this time, I was like, holy shit, that's Andrew Devoff. That's pretty awesome.
Yep,
so
exactly.
You've got future, you know, horror royalty, you know, in the early days right there. So yeah, you know, Bill, what did you think of Kelly Wolfe as Jane, the lone female on the cleanup crew?
I loved her. I liked how she was so it was great, you know, tough, also vulnerable too a bit, maintained her femininity, but could also stand her ground, you know, all of that great stuff that you know I want to see in a strong female character. I liked her a lot. But you brought that up for a reason, so what did I miss?
Well, you know, something interesting, and I didn't notice this till I looked at the cast listing, because in the short story, her last name is Wisconsky, and in the short story, there's a character named Wisconsky, but this is an interesting change. The character is like this, I get the impression that it's like a middle-aged, very neurotic guy who hangs out with our hero, Hall. So I thought it was interesting that they kind of switched it up, you know, instead of this neurotic male character who's like kind of like the Doubting Thomas or the Why Me or whatever kind of thing. They turned that character into like this assertive female character. And Kelly Wolfe is of short stature, which I thought was interesting. And I wonder if that was intentional because, oh, it's like you look at her initially and you think, oh, she can't be that tough. Because she's, you know, the guys are towering over her, kind of, but she's not like that at all. You know, she's had her run-ins with the foreman. She was at risk of becoming one of his payroll conquests, kind of. There's this thing that he's doing seedy stuff with the women he hires. But she, like, stands up to him and, you know, she puts up a fight, and I kind of like that. And something that came out of the interviews on the Blu-ray is that there was apparently a whole romantic subplot, including a shower scene between her and David Andrews, that was left on the cutting room floor. Now, Bill, do you think something like that was necessary, Bill, or do you think the film was fine without that bit of subplot going on?
It's funny that you brought that up. We could even do a whole show on this, on the elements of, you know, romance and horror movies when, you know, when you have a character and it's like, it wasn't poignant to the story, you know, it really wasn't a necessity. You don't have to have, you know, we saw that there was obvious, clearly affection and everything else, you know, so, you know, we didn't need to be hit over the head with a shower scene or anything like that. My gosh, even in, you know, it's not listed as a horror, and I wish it was, you know, Starship Troopers, you know, we have this relationship between Denise Richards and Muldoon, you know, who plays Xander, and that's all cut out. We don't need it. We already know all the implications are there. We don't need to see anything else. We saw her with a relationship with Johnny Rico, and, you know, we didn't need it. The movie would have been 3 hours long, and, you know, it would have slowed it down in spots. There was no need for it. It's only, you know, if it's an important part, you know, I think you need it, but I didn't think it was necessary.
I think back in that time, Bill, you would often find it's a lot of movies I felt shoehorned in romantic subplots where none were really needed. It was just we got to do this. You know, someone wants to see Tom Cruise in the shower with somebody or something, so we're going to put a scene in with that or something. You know, just as a for instance. So I was kind of, you know, apparently Kelly Wolfe was kind of disappointed because it was a big deal to her that she did that scene, because she was very tense about it, and she felt proud for kind of pulling it off. But at the same time, I was like, I think that would have maybe tripped up the movie a little bit and sort of gotten it off track. And I liked the moment really close to the end where she and David Andrews, they just share a kiss briefly.
Right.
You know,
I love that too. It was perfect. The timing was excellent,
and it added to the story at that point. Otherwise, it would have been like, oh, okay, they're just, you know, it's just a kiss, you know, just.
Yeah, because I think that the film really set up, you know, at that point, things have really, you know, spiraled off. So I think that kind of really, it helps give a sense of the stakes, and it's just, you know, brief, and it just communicates so much, almost like with that whole romantic subplot cut out of the movie, you get the impression that, okay, well, maybe once the movie's over with, these two will kind of walk off into the sunset to another town that doesn't have a really bad rat infestation. but unfortunately, that's not what happens. But one could hope. You know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, I was actually happy with that, because on the one hand, I was like, oh, shit, you know, I can't believe they did that. And then I'm like, well, I'm glad they did that, because, you know, I always hate when you know nothing's going to happen to a particular character, you know, and it's like, oh, am I watching a Disney film? Everything's going to be fine. You know?
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, Bill, that whole sequence is really, it's really kind of brutal and
yes.
Ugly, you know, like the violence of it, like the fighting and the fighting and the stabbing, it's just very, like, it's very blind ragey at that point between the characters, you know. It is like, oh my god, it's a real ugly slugfest, and it's taking place on piles of bones and in mucky god knows what water. Maybe it's puddles of piss that the creature is leaving, who knows. Yeah,
no, I agree with you. You know, the movie was building in many different ways towards a lot of different things, and they did it without it feeling contrived. Like, that brutal attack occurs just after that kiss, and they're both poignant, and they're both, like, you know, climaxes in their own small way for subplots and stuff, but it didn't feel, nothing felt forced or anything like that, because at that point, I'm like, where the fuck are we, man? Because this is like, it's a whole new world. It's like the set that they used in the old Beauty and the Beast with Linda Hamilton, you know, and Ron Perlman, you know, where they have this underground, insanely gigantic Middle Earth type world. It's like, what is going, where the hell are we? And like, oh God, no, look, oh my God, what an asshole that guy is, you know, and like, you know, and you go from there. And it's really funny because this was written by Stephen King as well as John Esposito, who went on to do several of the Walking Dead television episodes. And this is really wild, too. It's directed by Ralph S. Singleton. This is his only feature film. He's mostly a producer. This is it. This is the only movie he directed.
Yeah, and you know what? I gotta say, he did a good job with it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if he was like, you know what? Screw this shit. This is crazy. I would love to talk to him and find out, like, why are you one and done? Like, did it have to do with how it was received at the box office? Because other people's careers weren't dumped on. I mean, you know, Kelly Wolf, you know, she only had minor parts after that, which is really disconcerting. But yeah. Stephen Mocked, you know, he went on to bigger, better things. David Andrews, always a working actor. Andrew Devoff, you know, Brad Dourif.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and, you know, several others down the line there. But like, this whole movie's, like, weird. Like, people never really talked about it when it first came out. Like, it's like, I don't know. It just has this weird mystique about it.
Yeah, you know, Bill, I think there was something interesting with kind of the timing of this movie. Because like I was saying, this was at a time when, you know, studios were snatching up the rights to Stephen King stuff, because just his name alone would make you, you know, at least first weekend box office. So I feel like with this one, you know, Pet Sematary came out from Paramount, same studio, a year prior, and Ralph S. Singleton was the producer on that.
Right.
And I think Pet Sematary was a financial success, but I don't think it was well received critically, from what I remember. I mean, of course, people have reappraised it today, but I think it was pretty brutal back then, because this is back at a time when people were just like, oh, it's just another horror film. Oh, it's a Stephen King movie. How, you know? And I think Graveyard Shift, I think, suffered an even less ceremonious kind mm-hmm. of fate, because, you know, it was a lesser known story, I think. And it was just like, I think people just viewed it as it's just another horror movie. It's just gore and monsters and quote unquote bad actors, you know, nobody you've heard of. And, you know, I think the critical establishment, for as much as I don't like the gatekeeping smugness of a lot of online critics these days, right. Who often call for the reappraisal of stuff. But I think back then it was definitely more vicious and less charitable than it is today. So I would, you know, but it's interesting on the bonus features. Ralph Singleton has two interviews on the Blu-ray.
I can't wait to get it.
But he seems to, you know, his biggest complaint seems to be the fact that the Rat Bat monster just refused to work most of the time, sort of like Bruce and Jaws, apparently.
Yeah, but bat monsters are prone to do that, Johnny, so it should come as no surprise. I mean, come on.
Two things that aren't supposed together somehow don't work. I don't know how that
happens. Yeah, come on, Singleton, come on. What's the real truth? It's a conspiracy! Sorry, I'm all right.
But he seemed to look back favorably on the experience of making it, so maybe he just wanted to go back to something that was a little... I don't know, maybe he wanted to go back to producing. Maybe it was less of a hassle to do that instead. So it's he doesn't say too much bad about the production or the experience of making the movie. So I found that kind of interesting, because it goes to your question. Like, he seemed to have a grasp on what he was doing, and the film certainly doesn't suffer, I don't think, in terms of pacing. He keeps things going along pretty well, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just totally captivated by Stephen Macht. I mean, he was just...
Yes.
He just, like, friggin' owned that role, which he's apt to do. I mean, he always has this, like, presence, and he just... Like, as soon as you saw him, and he had that little smile on his face, you just wanted to beat the crap out of him, you know? It's just like... And he maintained that the whole movie up until the bitter end, and it was like, you bastard, and...
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's weird, because we were talking about Stephen King stories. Like, they were like, okay, hey, here's another Stephen King story. It's making it into a movie. There was like a dry... This was part of that dry run era for Stephen King movies. You know, we had, like, Maximum Overdrive, which Stephen King directed. Said first and last movie he'll ever direct, because he, you know, that was such a disaster. And Graveyard Shift. And then after that, Sleepwalkers.
Yeah, that's true.
And Sleepwalkers is, like, it's a guilty pleasure for me. That movie is such a train wreck. I love it. And I got the Blu-ray of it special. I think it's a special edition, because I'm like, yes, I am a masochist. And
that's another Scream Factory release, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember Doug, you know, McCambridge from Good Times, Great Movies, when I told him, holy shit, I found a DVD of Sleepwalkers at the library sale for $1. And he said, you paid too much, you know? It's like, damn, that's cold.
Some of Doug's opinions are pretty, I look at him like, Doug, really? With some of the stuff he likes.
Oh, I know. That's what I'm saying. Here, I'm like, dude, you talk about throwing stones, man.
Yeah, but I mean... It's that interesting thing with Graveyard Shift that neither one of us cared for it when we first watched it, and then all of a sudden somehow it's I don't know, it's somehow appreciated in our estimation in the years since.
I think I might have an answer, because I was thinking about this, Johnny.
Please, yeah.
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, since I saw Green Room in 2016, that was like the last great horror movie I'd seen, and I mean one that goes on my best of list. I haven't seen anything since. I haven't seen anything that was independent from another country that was really super worthwhile. It doesn't mean that I didn't see any great films, but we've reached a point where horror in general, even from an independent standpoint, is so overly stylized, overly lit. The mm-hmm. stories are there. It's almost like everyone's afraid across the board to take any chances at all.
Yeah.
That in the 80s, it was almost like
And this was, you know, I'm giving him a legitimate scream out later, but, you know, Losman was talking. He's Losman94 on Twitter. He was talking about, like, yeah, there were a lot of, you know, great strange movies in the 80s. And it was like these almost anything goes plots, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of political incorrectness.
Oh, yeah.
Or that we, you know, wasn't politically incorrect now, but looking back, you know, is or whatever. But, like, more chances were taken because there was, like, I think less fear involved with producers and everyone else about offending anybody. And it's like, well, yeah, let's do this, let's do that. And it was a good, solid story. Like you said, from the beginning, it starts off, it keeps going, it doesn't lag. Even in the parts where it's a little soft, they're important parts and mm-hmm. they're quick. Yeah. And, like, now you have, like, every movie seems, it's all cookie cutter. It's like, oh, wait, don't tell me the ghost is going to come in from the left. Cue the, you know, the little shrieky violin. Holy shit, there it is. And it's like, I just sit there and I fall asleep watching horror movies now. They're awful.
Yeah, you know, Bill, there something that I was taken aback with this movie is that there is a lot of genuine, like you were mentioning, the production design, which is fantastic. It looks like, it actually looks like when they start descending down through that trap door, it looks like stuff left over from James Whale's Frankenstein. It's like the leftover lab setup or something. It's all this weird industrial shit sitting around in disuse, and I kind of love that. And there's like mist rising up from the floor.
Yeah, I'm like, where the fuck are we, really? I'm like, holy shit, where are these people?
it really is like the notion that you're like descending into hell almost, you know. You've got level by level. You know, because everything in the movie seems to be coming down from, it's like the shit rolls downhill notion. It's like everything is coming from up on high, and you keep just going down further. You thought that basement was humid and hot while you were cleaning it up. Oh, here's this trapdoor that's going to lead you into something even more awful than just being hot all the time. Yeah.
Another universe, man. I so wish now that there was a line where someone says, this is hell, and Brad Dourif goes, this isn't hell, this is rat hell. You know, just something like that, you know? But, like, you're right, when he opened up that trap door, it's like Alice, you know, in Wonderland, and it's an un-Wonderland, and it's like, and that's why I'm sitting there, and I'm like, what, really, what the hell's going on? It's like, it just keeps growing and expanding, and it's just, and I'm glad they didn't try to answer anything, like, well, why did this happen? You know, I just loved how it's like, this is it. And the characters don't know and will never know what really happened, and you won't either. And I just really appreciated that.
There is this sense, Bill, that, yeah, to what you were saying, it's like, I think part of the reason this movie works is, even if you've read the short story, which is like 15 pages or something like that, and only a small chunk of the movie is reflective of the short story, mm-hmm. you know, there is this sense that, and I've mentioned this before with other movies that we've talked about, Green Room being one of them, is that you're not ahead of the characters.
I love that. So
like what you're experiencing, like what you're watching the characters experience, you're experiencing for the first time. Nobody is ahead of anybody else, so you're not doing that annoying thing where something's happened to some other characters, so you got to wait for the other characters to catch up to what's happened to the other characters, and it's just terrible. I hate that.
I despise that. You know, that's the true definition for me, from my perspective, of what I call a Flintstone plot, where Wilma knew one part of the answer, Fred knew the other, and you're waiting the whole fucking half-hour episode for them to finally go, oh, and I hate that crap, and
that's some sitcom bullshit right there.
It's awful, but I hate it when it's in horror movies, and I hate when we have to see it. I hate it on television shows. This is why I hated this is why I didn't like The Walking Dead. This is why mm-hmm. one of many reasons. That's why Stranger Things is awesome. No, it's not. It's shit. I fucking hate it. It's awful. Absolutely awful. And it's the same thing. You have like five different characters knowing five different pieces to the puzzle, but no one talks to each other. And it's like...
You spend a whole damn season waiting for all the pieces to come together, yeah.
And I'm like, come on, I don't want to be ahead. I want to be freaked out. I want to be freaked out just like the characters are freaked out. Mm-hmm. And in this, you're freaked out because every time they go someplace new, you're like, holy shit. And they're like, holy shit. It was just great. I just loved that. I love that element of they're peeling apart this onion that they didn't even know was a friggin' onion to begin with. And they're peeling off the layers and you're there with them experiencing it for the first time. This is why The Thing worked so well, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, John Carpenter's thing. They're like, what's going on? We don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going on. We don't know how anybody got to the blood. Was it really Gary? Was it the doc? But he gave the key right back to him, you know? And it's like, holy shit. And you're like, it was great.
Phil, where did MacReady hide the tape? I want to know where MacReady hid the tape.
I know. We were talking about that before the show. It's like, that's a whole new movie. Somebody in like 2020, you know, they have the whole new thing built up and it's like, hey, what's this? Hey, it's next to a frozen dog. Let's reanimate that dog. Nothing could go wrong. Sorry. I'm out of control.
No. It's cool, man. Because I agree with that. And I like the moment once they descend the stairs and what's his name, Brogan.
Yeah.
Brogan gets killed and everybody just like bolts off and splits up. They do the thing you're not supposed to do in a horror movie. They split off and they run in different directions. But it makes sense in the moment, I feel, that they wind up where they are and that the characters who are together wind up together. Like Andy Devoff is with Stephen Mocht because they're both kind of weaselly, nefarious characters, and then David Andrews and Kelly Wolf wind up together because, well, there's that romantic subplot that got cut out, but they're, for all intents and purposes, the good, pure-hearted characters of the piece. So we have these two factions that are split up, and then they converge one last time in the movie, which I kind of liked that.
Yeah, and Brogan was played by Vic Palizos, who went on to... he's already just finished two other projects.
Oh, wow.
You know, he's got 100 plus, and he's also a director. And he was great in that. He was like, oh, I can't wait for him to die. You know, it was just like...
I got to give him credit for the scene where an actual spider walks across his face. I was like, oh, I could not do that. But, Bill, I wanted to ask you about Brogan, because I thought this was interesting the last time I was watching it. So what they're doing to clean out this basement is they have this huge, like, fire hose that they're using just to push stuff.
Oh, it's awful.
But I thought it was interesting is that Singleton is often filming Brogan with the hose at, like, waist level. So it looks like a phallic symbol. It looks like he's ejaculating every time in grand fashion.
Urinating, Johnny. You went right to ejaculation, you sick bastard.
Well, here's the other thing, Bill. You remember there was a time in movies, like after Rambo, First Blood Part 2, where you would have these action stars, like in lesser like B movies, they'd always be screaming while they shot their weapons, kind of.
Because I
feel like in Graveyard Shift, that was kind of Singleton's way of like nodding to those action movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Only it's kind of like the schlubby Brogan, you know, who's this big fat guy with his hose that makes him feel like a man, kind of, and he's going every time he lets loose with the pressure. So,
no, that's so true. You nailed it. That was definitely it. It was just like, oh man. It was just so really cool because, like, I remember sitting there, and I only saw this, a few months ago, and I'm like, holy shit, man, this is great. And I'm like, why? How come I didn't I see this? And I knew I did because of Brad Dourif, but I, like, couldn't remember my first viewing at all. And I don't know what was different then and what's different now other than, you know, I was definitely more appreciative of it. There was definitely a better story there. Maybe I saw it when I was too young and just like, this is stupid. And instead of realizing like, wow, no, this is actually really well crafted, you know, from a storytelling standpoint.
Well, and something I like, Bill, is that there's a real sense of weird political intrigue going on at this mill because Warwick is Warwick is very Machiavellian as a character. You know, it'd be one
a little bit.
It'd be one thing if he were just like a regular sleazebag, but you know, he's very crafty. Obviously, he's been doing this job for a long time, and he knows how to grease the proper wheels. Because you know, the first thing we see him do is basically pay off the health inspector or the
right
safety inspector. Then you see him like talking to Brad Dourif, and Brad Dourif is like, later on, like at the midpoint, he's like refusing to do something or something, and then Warwick is like brings up something that gets him to sit back down and take notice. And I really like that. He's like, he's such a creep, and you think Brad Dourif's kind of a creep too, because he's just got that oily hairdo. And he tells that great story at the beginning of the movie, which obviously is not in the short story, about what do Viet Cong rats like to eat.
Yep.
And it's actually really disturbing. He starts off really hamming it up, and then as he's given that monologue to David Andrews, it's like, holy crap, this is a really disturbing story, which was probably based in some sort of reality that he was telling, you know?
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it.
It sounds very like something that would have happened during that time. So
yeah, and that always ticks me off, because Brad Dourif is a phenomenal actor. Everything he's done, drama, comedy, whatever. He was nominated for an Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he's just, you know, like, he ends up doing movies like this, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's just like, you expected to see him in bigger, grander movies and playing, you know, more established roles. Is it because he didn't have the look or something like that? You know, and it's like, I don't know. He got robbed, man.
Yeah, I mean, he has. I mean, the good thing about him is that he's just done so much that you would never lack for a Brad Dourif movie. Unfortunately, yeah, some of them are much better than others.
And Deadwood, the series, I was like, awesome, man. He's getting steady work, you know. Like,
oh, I still gotta watch Deadwood. Oh.
What?
And I met William Sanderson a couple of years ago.
So did
I still gotta see Deadwood.
Do you know what he said?
What did he say?
I said, man, you were great in Deadwood. I was glad to finally see you in a solid role. And he said, yeah, me too, man. Because of Deadwood, my wife and I could finally buy a house. And I'm like, damn.
That's great. You know what? His memoir is really entertaining and very, it depicts him as very much the humble guy that he often plays, I think, in movies. But you know, seeing him speak at a Q&A, he was obviously so self-conscious and you know, obviously kind of struggling with the crowd that was there, and I just felt that really humanized the guy. I felt kind of bad for him. I felt good that there were so many people coming out to see him, but at the same time I was like, oh, that poor guy, his nerves are probably racked, because he's so humble about his work and his contribution to
he really was. And I met him and his wife, and we sat and we talked for like 15-20 minutes, and it was just so sweet. It was such a wonderful time. And that was the same day I met Michael Berryman. We talked for a half hour. and I finally met the Candyman himself, the great Tony Todd. We talked for a while, and that was wonderful, and I still have the candy, the Mary Jane candy Lee gave me. And this was like 10 years ago or something, but...
Nice.
Yeah, so it was great. That was Paranormal Fest, which doesn't exist anymore. And
were you talking to him about The Man from Earth, Bill?
Oh, yeah. It was funny, because I didn't realize how big he was, like, you know, football linebacker big and shit.
Oh, and he's tall. Yeah,
and he walks into the room, and I think I took a step back. I'm like, holy shit! And and it's like, he doesn't need a hook on his hand, you know, to freak people out. And he was very nice, and he sits down, and he's doing his thing. And then I said, you know, I loved, you know, your horror work, but you really blew me away in The Man from Earth. And then, like, there was a switch,
And he was like, whoa, you know, it was like, thank you very much. You know, and you could tell he took, you know, great, you know, pride in that, which he should. It was an excellent film. And he's played such an impassioned part, you know, in this amazing, you know, sci-fi drama from Mr. Jerome Bixby.
Yeah, and that's another movie I have you to thank for watching, Bill, because I would never have known about it if you hadn't told me about it years ago. And I was just like, what a simple... It's really like a filmed play, basically. It's just literally characters in a room talking, and to me, they keep it interesting for 90 minutes. That's good storytelling right there.
Absolutely, man. Can't disagree with that at all. I was really impressed by that film. It's wonderful, wonderful film.
Yeah. So. We got off track here, but do you have?
It's our show. We could do what we want.
Yeah, that's true, Bill. I mean, do you have any closing thoughts on the longevity of Graveyard Shift, or anything you want to bring up that we haven't?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Because Johnny and I are celebrating it on its 30th anniversary, you should too. Damn it, you should too. Tell your friends about it. Watch it with have a watch party, whatever. Have a virtual watch party because of COVID-19.
Oh hell yeah!
Whatever. It's really worth a revisit. And if you haven't seen it at all yet, definitely do. If you're a Stephen King fan, you have to put it in and play it. You know, you get kicked out of the club. I know that for a fact. But no, it really should be seen by people because it was really entertaining. The acting's great. It has a great look and feel to it. The atmosphere's solid. The weirdness of it is definitely there. And that's something that's really missing from a lot of horror movies today is the weirdness factor, you know. Yeah. And it's, you know, Ralph S. Singleton did a great job. So did the entire cast in creating something that I hope you... If you haven't seen it, you'll find it better than expected.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with all of that, Bill. And I felt very validated when after I made that tweet about watching it again, and Craig Palko's like, oh man, I love that.
Yeah!
And he posted some sort of memorabilia item that he used to have but didn't anymore. I was like, oh, that was, we have the Craig Palko seal of approval, so that's kind of all I need. Something I wanted to mention there, Bill, was that I love that opening scene with the one guy running the pick-a.
Yeah.
And he's even wearing a red shirt. You know what's going to happen to him. He's not going to be one of our heroes who's going to...
Yeah.
We're probably not going to see him much after the pre-title sequence. But I love his little discourse with the mice that come by and watch him.
The rats, yeah.
Yeah, and something that really gets established in those opening few minutes is the thermometer that's at 100 degrees at like early in the morning, and how sweaty and dirty this guy is, how sweaty and dirty everybody is in this movie. It feels like it actually reminded me convincingly of like how hot it was when they were filming the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre down in Texas. Like, it was like 100 or more degrees outside. So that film really had that, left you with that feeling that, oh my God, this is not, they're not spraying water on these people to make them look like they're hot. They're actually hot. And I got the same.
They're dying. We're watching them really die.
I'm seriously wondering if there was something similar going on with Graveyard Shift, because that dirt, that grit, that sweat, all of that felt very real to me, and I really like that. Mm-hmm. I thought that went a long way and towards creating that, this oppressive, this place sucks already because the foreman's a real demon, but it sucks even worse because there's no air conditioning. You gotta schlep these huge bags of stuff around in the heat, and there's no release from any of it.
Yeah, it felt, as soon as you hear the word, working at the mill, it's like, ooh, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of mill it is. A mill equals dirt, scunge, low wages, unhappiness, you know.
Yeah.
And we all know that there's something underneath the floor.
Yeah, and you know what, Bill, one last thing I'll say, because this popped into my head the last time I watched it, this might make a good double feature with Session 9, which is also about people cleaning up a place.
Wow, man, I didn't even think of that. That would be great.
And I like how both those movies really turn something as mundane as cleaning up a basement or cleaning asbestos. They spin it into an interesting story about something. Session 9's more psychological, but
Session 9's something special, man.
Oh, it is. I love that movie too. So it's like, I think you want two movies that have that premise but take totally different approaches to it. Sandwich, you know, stick these two together and see what happens. Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah,
excellent. So watch it, ladies and gentlemen, and I know the people I'm going to scream out to right now, they've probably seen it several times, and if not, they're definitely going to watch it now. I would hope. But well, first, you know, to Palco Designs, Johnny mentioned him at the end. If it's Palco Designs approved, you know it's awesome. He has one of the greatest horror collections I've ever seen. Follow him on Twitter, please, at Palco Designs. And these are also great souls you could find on Twitter. And here we go. I'm going to give you their names or whatever and give you their Twitter handles, tell you a little bit about them. R.J. Crowther Jr., and he is a science fiction thriller horror writer who took his shadow by the hand and a bookseller at Mysterious Galaxy, the haunted mansion. Oh my God, I'm drinking right now, Johnny. Hold on. Why do I always do this?
You're walking too much. You're walking too much in that hot basement, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like cotton in my mouth. Oh. The haunted mansion is my happy place. And he's out of beautiful San Diego. So there you go, R.J. Crowther Jr. Follow him on Twitter. G is mostly absent while rebooting. And who's that? That is Cyber Sphinx, Sphynx. Circumspect Lone Ranger, drafter of unfinished novels. Secessional, Dr. G. Gothic, she's into gothic studies, dystopias, online since 92. She's pro-diversity. She's out of beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. And definitely follow her. I love the wit. The wonderful Chris Mantillo, and that is Doc Mantillo on Twitter. Award-winning horror writer, horror producer, true crime television journalist, actor, record label founder of the world's first monthly arts awards. He's out of Boston, a beautiful city. And also check him out at muckrake.com. Always tweeting our shows. Really appreciate the love from Chris. Thank you so much, sir. The Losman. Who's that? I just mentioned him before. Losman 94. Creator of Losman's Lair of Horror and Losman's Horror Blog. He's into horror, sci-fi, cult cinema, aviation, craft beer, and the Midnight Manor podcast. Out of San Antonio. And check him out on Losman.com. Also nearby, from, well, we'll just say Halloween Town, USA. The lovely, the phenomenal actress, and also what a singer, what a vocalist, Nicole M. Alonso. She plays Tank in CrawlerDieTrilogy.com. We'll go to CrawlerDieTrilogy.com. I still believe the sequel, which they're filming right now in Oklahoma, by director, writer, and editor Oklahoma Ward. I don't think it has a title yet, but they are still filming even now. Check her out on IMDb at Nicole Alonso on IMDb.com. And she's also a Twitch affiliate at Tank TV Twitch. The wonderful GR44, who's that? That is the Cinema Ticket. Movie fan in love with the technological medium that has harnessed the stuff of which dreams are made. He's out of Cork, Ireland, and you can check out more at the Cinema Ticket. .wordpress.com. Horror and Haunted with an N. Horror movie reviews and news turned to paranormal talk videos, and this is from the Horror Art Paranormal Photography News Weird. So how about that? I do spooky photography, post to inspire creativity, which he does, plus just some cheesy humor. No DMs, damn it, out of Ohio by a lot of cornfields. The wonderful, out of the Midwest. Man, we're moving all over the country today, Johnny. The great BJ Frazier. And you could follow her at XXXBJFrazier. Farzier, erotica author specializing in femdom. Severe content warning for all of you wimps out there. Books contain plots and well-developed characters if you wanted to know. You could also follow her at BJ Fraser NSFW, femdom, erotica, BDSM, and also go to beautiful website, bjfraser.com. Just published her 24th or 25th story. She's probably publishing the 26th one right now. Wonderful, wow. Prolific, very cool person. Abhorrently_URS. Abhorrently yours. Horror movie enthusiast, cinephile, lover of the macabre and morbid, mama, wolf, senior English teacher. I say fuck a lot. She's out of Texas. She is absolutely amazing. Cool as hell. Check her out. Also, the great Duncan Ralston that you could find at UserBits.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Author of Salvage, Womb, WOOM, and Ghostland. Horror Writers Association active member. Lost superfan. Voracious eater. Out of Toronto, the one major Canadian city I haven't gotten to yet. But you could also follow him at DuncanRalston.com. So those souls are amazing. Check them out. Enjoy them.
Absolutely.
That's it for Scream Outs, Johnny.
All right, Bill. Well, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are no H's in those Johnnies, but there are B's in those Numbs. And you can find my writing at CrashPalaceProductions.com because Billy's a sweetheart. And you can also find my writing at 1428elm.com. Billy, where can people find you?
Well, I'm down at the mill. And, jeez, can you imagine?
Someone better call break.
Oh, yeah, please. Anyway, you can find me at Crash Palace on Twitter. Also at CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show and more with great articles from Johnny Numb as well as other fantastic souls. And for those fantastic souls who've written for the Crash Palace in the past, please do so again. That would be really nice. I'd love to publish your work, and you all know who you are. And you could also follow me on Noir Kink for links to my crazy erotic crime thriller novels. And the latest one, Debauchery, should be out shortly. The cover is now complete, so we're like couple weeks away.
I'm excited, Bill.
So am I, I think.
From a literary and other standpoints, yeah.
Thank you. Every time I read, like, how can I make it weird? You know, it's like, how can I make it weird but plausible? That's my mantra. Weird but plausible. How about that?
Well, Bill, I told you with Punishment, you had a scene in there that I was like, that was a really clever way to kill someone.
Oh, thank you very much.
And I think you know what I'm talking about.
I know, you sick bastard. But I want to thank you. I don't know if I have publicly or not, but when I was telling you about the story and where it was, you said, hey, you have this one scene that you need to take from near the end and put it at the beginning. And I remember wanting to murder you because I was like, the overhaul it's going to take. But I looked at it and I was like, holy shit, Johnny's right. He just saved the book. And I moved it, and it took over 3 weeks just to get that transfer in and get all, because when you write a book, man, shit's hidden everywhere. It's like, oh, that's a clue for something that happened before and it can't, oh my God. And so I made all these changes, and it, thanks to you, Johnny, that the book came together the way it did. So I'm much appreciated.
Yeah, you know, Bill, no problem. And, you know, I really enjoyed talking shop with you. It was probably, like, what, 2 years ago we were sitting out on the sun porch looking at traffic go by and...
Yep, I remember.
And watching music videos and talking about writing. And it was just I would love to have that kind of conversation again. I hope we are able to in the near future.
I hope so too, because I'm going to work on the fourth book, but I have to talk to you first about it. I'm like, Johnny will know. Johnny will have this answer. He's like a sage on a mountain.
We'll get coffee, Bill. We'll talk from a social distance.
All right, man.
Social distance.
Awesome. Looking forward to it.
Oh, me too. I'm looking forward to reading what you come up with, man.
Oh, boy. This third book's a doozy, man.
Yay!
Yay to a doozy. Yeah, you wait. I can't wait for your feedback, good, bad, or otherwise.
Just let me know when the order link is up. I'm gonna get it.
You're too kind. All right.
No problem.
Well, you know, I got to get ready for the graveyard shift, Johnny. So.
Someone called dinner for Billy. He's a growing boy.
I'm going to dream about you doing that voice tonight. It's going to freak me out. I'm sure Stephen King's like, what the hell, man? What the hell's going on?
I'm sure Stephen Mocked wants to strangle me right now for even attempting to mimic his greatness in that movie. But yeah.
Oh, man.
It would be an honor to be strangled by Warwick. So, yeah.
And we're out of here at Mocked 5. Have a good night, Johnny.
Good one, Bill. See ya.
Bye.